Welcome to Guerrillapreneur, the Art of Waging Small Business Warfare podcast, teaching Davids how to defeat Goliaths. Now here's your host, Mark Anthony Peterson.
Welcome back to the podcast for entrepreneurs, startups, and business mavericks. If you're not a maverick, you don't have to go home, but you got to get up out of this podcast. In this podcast, we teach entrepreneurs how to defeat the corporate giant. Just like in the story of David and Goliath, David defeated a much taller and stronger Goliath, not by fighting the giant in hand-to-hand combat, but by using technology. A slingshot. The slingshot allowed the smaller David to attack from a distance that minimized the advantages that Goliath had over the smaller David. My name is Mark Anthony Peterson. I am a serial entrepreneur, a futurist, and the managing executive at Serial Consulting, a leading small business strategy and technology consulting firm. I am also the author of the book Guerrillapreneur, Small Business Strategy for Davids Wanting to Defeat Goliaths, which is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and iTunes. This podcast is brought to you by Serial Consulting. An idea can launch a business. A strategy can take it global. Welcome to episode 12. Episode 12 is a mastermind interview episode. And in these episodes, we have conversations with startups about the issues they face in their quest to create value. Today, we traveled to Decatur, Georgia, to meet with Julie Farr, the owner of Shared Kitchen LLC. Kitchen incubators, which offer space for rent as well as membership for aspiring restaurateurs, have emerged as a culinary business trend since 2011. According to USA Today, in 2016, there were an estimated 135 commercial shared-use kitchens in the United States, with incubators taking hold in urban areas such as New York, San Francisco, and now Atlanta. Most kitchen incubators include rental commercial kitchens along with dry, refrigerated, and freezer storage. They also provide business, marketing, administrative support, and educational tools to restaurateurs. The kitchen incubators are essentially telling food entrepreneurs that their ideas matter. And as the feature song from Shaletta Burke says, you belong.
What's wrong with belong?
That was Shaletta Burke, our feature artist for this episode, giving us a clip from her single, Belong. We feature a longer clip of her single, Belong, after the interview with Julie Farr. Over the first 11 episodes of the Art of Waging Small Business Warfare podcast, we've interviewed several food entrepreneurs, including the founders of G Mama's Cookies, Two Dough Girls, and Too Good Cocoa. After talking with these entrepreneurs who leverage shared kitchens to launch their businesses, it makes sense to interview an entrepreneur who has decided to invest their money in capital and build their business model around sharing that capital with hundreds of food entrepreneurs. Here is my interview with Julie Farr, co-owner of the Shared Kitchen LLC, located in Decatur, Georgia.
So background, I grew up in the metro Atlanta area, graduated from Kennesaw State University in, surprisingly enough, accounting. I have no background per se in the food industry, but spent several years after my accounting background, a couple years at home with my kids, got a little restless, wanted to do something a little different, so I started direct sales. And that's where I really found, I think, a passion for entrepreneurship and for, you know, holding the reins of your own horse, so to speak. And particularly, I enjoyed mentoring other entrepreneurs and other people that were starting their business and training and encouraging them. So when the Shared Kitchens idea came into be, it just seemed to be such a natural progression from what had really fueled me before into this field. And, you know, I think that our expertise and my expertise was certainly on the business side and understanding what it took from a resource collection to get it up and going and to keep it going. It seemed like such a natural fit, you know, for what, even though I didn't have experience experience per se in the food industry, seeing people come in and start a business and build a business and strive for their own success is just something that's always been where my heart lies. So it really does seem to be a very natural path for us to take.
Had you ever launched or thought about launching any sort of culinary cookies, brownies?
No.
So just this hits you one day that shared kitchens is the thing that direct sales after an accounting degree.
Right.
That this is where
we take strange paths sometimes, and
right.
it really was kind of an interesting evolution of the idea because I do enjoy feeding people, I'll say, and my husband and I used to do a lot of entertaining, whether it was family events or little league parties at our house, and we did some team building for his coworkers, and I always enjoyed making the food for that. But I never fancied myself, having the skills to do that on a professional basis. It was just something that I really enjoyed. But it was very frustrating to me when I would do that because I didn't have enough at home. I didn't have enough prep space. I didn't have enough cold storage to be able to really prep before the event like I would like to. So I was scurrying around on the day of the event. And I remember thinking, oh, it'd be so awesome if there was a place I could go where I had a walk-in cooler and I had prep space and I had speed racks and I could get everything set up ahead of time. And that kind of just started my wheels rolling because I thought, I'm just trying to have a party here. What do people do when they're trying to start a business? So once my wheels kind of got going, then I started doing kind of broad stroke numbers in my head of, what would it take to, what kind of resources would that take? What would it take to keep something like that going? Is there a need in the marketplace? Kind of got running. I was 100 miles an hour. My husband's the more grounded of us. It's like, oh, wait a minute. Come on. Let's sit down. Let's write a business plan. Let's walk this through the steps. And so we did all that. And by the time we got through the business plan and we had, some financing approval, I launched a website, Coming Soon, Shared Kitchens. And before the end of the day that I launched that website, I had had my first calls.
Wow.
And I would get people on the phone, and because we were the first in the state of Georgia to do this. And
year was that?
2008.
Okay.
And they would be so excited. They would just be, I can't believe I found you. I am so excited. I need this so badly. And then sometimes they would just get on and they would start telling me their passion and what they wanted to do. And there were just so much energy behind it. And so by the time we kind of got through the process and got our first lease signed and got the financing lined up and get ready to break ground, I had over 40 people on my contact list. And of course, not all of those came to, very few of them actually came to fruition. But, in talking to those in those first few, months, I just felt like this is obviously something the marketplace needs. And these people are passionate and they're energized and they're ready to go. They just need somebody to help them get through the process. So that energy, I think, was a really important piece of the puzzle because once we started moving forward, we hit regulatory walls, just bam, because it had never been done in
right.
the state of Georgia. And because of what we were trying to do as far as service and catering companies, as well as small production companies, we were dealing with the Department of Agriculture and Department of Health from
right.
a regulatory standpoint. And Department of Agriculture had a little bit more leeway in their regulations, and they were, gave us some guidelines. We had to tweak some things, but we kind of were moving forward with them. And we hit the health department, and they just put the brakes on me. They're like, nope, can't do it. It was just flat. It can't be done. And I don't do real well with no. I never felt like, I understood it wasn't like they were being malicious, but it was just within the framework of the regulation, there was just not a way to do this. So, I'm kind of thinking, no, that's not a good enough reason for it to be a no, not just because I don't like to be told no, but all these people that I've spoken with, they need this. And, even from a health and safety standpoint, which is the health department's objective, we don't want these people on the down low cooking out of their home and
That's
being
right.
illegal, because it's a lot more safe if we can bring them into an environment that we know can be regulated. So it took us about 11 months, but we eventually worked with the health department and actually ended up downtown with the state of Georgia health department and were able to craft a variance request. And then they were able to let us get going. So 11 months of battles later,
wow.
we finally got our first caterers in. And I think as we have grown, and then certainly other companies doing similar things to us have popped up, the they have a better framework, and they've kind of got a plan in place to regulate us.
You mentioned the first 40 that contacted mm-hmm. you. Why do you think they didn't follow through?
You know, there's a lot of barriers to entry in the market, and we can meet some of those, but not all of them. I think some people are better entrepreneurs than others. I think it's a lot easier to have a spark of an idea than it is to have a plan for implementation. So a lot of them, I think maybe feasibility didn't pan out for what they were trying to do when they looked at it a little bit more closely. And also, it's a lot of work. I think a lot of times people just had a tendency to say, you know, it's great when I cook these cookies that my friends and family all love. It would be totally different, and it is totally different, if I'm on a deadline and I've got to have 1,000 of them by Saturday morning. All of a sudden, then something that you're passionate about and you enjoy doing because you enjoy the reaction of your family and friends isn't the same. So, you know, I think a lot of people, and rightly so, take a different path. But, you know, I think the fact that what we can do and what we really build our core around is looking at the marketplace and seeing what are those barriers to entry and what can we do as a company to remove those. And certainly the largest of which is startup capital, like you alluded to. And that became really the driving force, because when I was back doing those broad stroke numbers in my head, those are large numbers.
Yes.
You know, depending on what type of business you're running, even if I, you know, if I want to even, let's say I want to make a cookie, I've got to lease a space. I've got to finish it out with the surfaces that are health department approved. So I've got to have tile floor. I've got to have FRP on the wall. I have to have scrubbable ceiling tiles. All that is much more expensive than just a normal, if I was opening up, you know, a computer shop or something. And then the equipment, of course, is extremely expensive. But then I think you take that a step further, even after that first startup capital, the ongoing fixed cost. Most of our companies, when they first come to us, they can come in a couple of days and produce enough product to last their sales cycle for, you know, usually a month or so, maybe more, depending on what kind of product they're doing. So if they had gone a traditional route, they would be paying full-time overhead for part-time production, which is going to make it very, very difficult to make the numbers work. Their margins would just have to be incredibly high in order to be able to sustain itself. So, you know, I think in addition to that initial outlay, the ongoing cost, it makes sense in this environment, because we have a group of assets here in the facility and the equipment that we can basically have working 24/7. Right. Now, we're not always that full, but if you come in and you work today, I can put somebody else behind you tonight, and those assets are still working. You know, they're working not only for our business, but for all the different businesses that we have here, and I think it makes sense from a financial standpoint. And I think the other thing we do in the shared environment is we take some of the hats away. One of the toughest, you know, challenges for all entrepreneurs is you wear so many hats. I mean, you are sales, you are marketing, you are janitorial, you right. are everything. And so by being here in a facility, they can focus on their core. They can focus on their product. They can focus on sales and distribution. If the oven goes down, that's our problem.
Right.
When the health department walks in and someone's got to walk them through the inspection, that's us. You know, so they don't have that burden. And, you know, food people tend to, and this is overgeneralizing, they tend to be kind of creative types. And so a lot of times they don't have a lot of patience for those little details. You know, they wouldn't enjoy having to keep the rent paid and the utility bill and cutting payables and that type of thing. And so by being able to take some of that administrative function away from them, then I think they really are able to really put their energy where it's best suited, which is in their product.
I mention that all the time on the podcast, that the toughest part of entrepreneurship is the multiple hats.
Right.
And we, over the last few podcasts, have talked about a framework mm-hmm. to help entrepreneurs look at those tasks and whether or not they should be outsourcing some of those. And then, as you say, focusing on the core as the ultimate goal.
Right.
And I think that's one of the toughest decisions for mm-hmm. a lot of the entrepreneurs, is making that decision on when to give up and invest in a task where someone else is going to be the expert
right.
so that they can focus on what makes their brand
right.
or their product different. And that's what I love about your business model. You spoke a little bit about the feasibility studies. Are you doing anything in that regard to help them close that gap, to help them understand their markets, or if they have a business approach that's going to lead to some value creation?
That's something we've talked about a lot in our long-range planning in particular is, you know, what other services can we bring to table as far as consulting services? At this point, we really are trying to stay in our lane a little bit, but we do work with some organizations and certainly refer out to, you know, organizations like SCORE and the SBDC, you know, if they feel like they need some business consulting. But not to say that we don't do a lot of that on an informal basis,
right,
because we've been around for 9+ years now, and we've seen a lot of companies, and almost 400 companies that have come through our doors in one capacity or another. So we've seen what works a lot of times, and we've seen what doesn't. So we certainly are frequently sharing that information, that insight, when asked, but we don't really do anything on a formal basis like that yet.
Yeah, I saw on the website, you showed us the co-packing. Mm-hmm. That was, I guess, an additional service that you branched out into.
And co-packing really came from our desire to continually look at our members and see how their businesses are evolving and how we can adapt and, you know, remain relevant to them through all their growth cycles. And what we really realized was, and it kind of, I don't know if you're familiar with the book, The E-Myth.
Mm-hmm.
And when she was talking about, and as years ago when I read that about, you know, she started out because she wanted to make pies. If she was going to be successful, she had to quit making pies and run her business.
Right.
And that's kind of what we look at with co-packing is certain types of product where the value of the product is in the recipe and not in
the actual doing.
A production.
That's,
you know,
right.
If the production part can be easily duplicated, sauces, jams, jellies, dry mixes, that type of thing, then by all means, the business owner's time should be spent sales, marketing, growing the business, and let me take it and put it in the bottle.
Right.
It just makes sense. And the other thing that it does on the co-packing side is it really, again, helps them match their expenses with their revenue. When they're first starting out, a lot of them, they're only going to be selling product maybe at the local farmers markets and festival. They only need, you know, maybe 10 cases at first. And then they don't have to pay again until they've gone through those 10 cases because, you know, subject to some pretty low minimums, we produce as they need it. And so it really allowed us to look at certain businesses and say, hey, you know what? We've got another way we think we can help you be successful. And it was a huge, huge turn for us to be able to adapt to that because I think that those types of products, especially that are very, very labor intensive, it's very hard for them to be commercially viable if you're having to wear all those hats because
Absolutely.
You just don't have time to stand and sweat over the pot and the bottle and the label and get the product into the marketplace as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. Well, while we're on that, give us a sense for the minimum cost and then up to the highest level of what members would have to pay to get access to that sort of support.
For on the co-packing side or on the membership side?
Membership side.
On the membership side, you can. We generally try and start everybody out on what we call our startup plan. Unless they're already established and have existing business in, we put them on that plan because it's the most flexible. So they can come in on that plan for $1,700. And what that's going to give them is 50 hours of kitchen time that they can use over a six-month period. So they could come in this month and they might use 20, and then they might not have any events next month. So they're still going to have those remaining 30 hours. It's not going to cut into
their time. So they roll over month to month.
It's going to be the only plan of ours that rolls over because those first few months especially are going to probably be very sporadic. And it's not uncommon for us to see somebody in that first month hit the ground running and then maybe have a lull because they were so busy working here, they weren't out marketing. So, you know, they may have a little lull after that. So, you know, that's going to also, it's enough time for them to really test, do I even enjoy doing this? Am I getting a good response in the marketplace? And at that point, once they've gone through the 50 hours or the 6 months, then they can roll on to one of our other plans. And those plans vary anywhere from a low of 20 hours per month up to a high of 80 hours per month. But none of them are truly limited. So our plan hours are at least.
Mm.
So on our lowest plan, it's $450 a month for at least 20 hours per month. So if you work 22 hours, then you paid your set fee, and then you're going to be billed for the two other hours. So as the plans go up, basically it just creates an economy of scale. The per hour rate gets a little bit lower the more time you're using, as you would expect. And they get a little bit more storage based on those plan levels as well. So I would say most of our little baby companies that aren't very large are still startup and emerging, or even sometimes it's a personal choice. They only want this to be a sideline business. Then they're going to stay at that 20-hour level. It's going to give them plenty of time to do what they need to do. And then as they grow, if they choose to, then they can move up through the plans. All of our plans are a 6-month term. So each time you renew, you're committing for 6 more months. So we feel like that's a very manageable chunk. It's important to us to have the commitment and know that they're serious about it, because we are tied to them from a licensing standpoint. So we can't have people coming in today and then never seeing them again, because they are tied to us. So I think it gives, you know, gives them the flexibility that they need, but still being reasonable from our standpoint on the expectations.
Have you seen, as the gig economy has ramped up, more people wanting to launch these kind of baby small side businesses?
You know, interestingly enough, when we first started in 2008, that was right at the beginning of the financial downturn, which impacted us a couple of ways. One, we were very, very fortunate that we had gotten approval on our financing before everything went south. Or we may not have gotten approval on our financing. But we also saw an astonishing amount of people that had been temporarily displaced by the economy. And so they would come in and tell us, you know, I've always wanted to try this. And now I got laid off, or my husband got laid off, and I'm looking for a little extra money on the side to tie us over or whatnot. So I think we really probably had some energy in that market that may have been a little bit flatter had it not been for that. So as unfortunate as that was, I think it did spur a lot of people to say, you know, let me look at, do I have other life choices that I can make? But I think that the marketplace just continues to be adaptive. So I think what we were doing was we were embracing an extremely elementary marketing concept of economies of scale. That's really all we did, was we said, you know what, we have high dollar assets, let's bring them in and let's spread the cost as much as we can. So, you know, I think the marketplace certainly has been adaptive to it, and I've seen some very interesting concepts from, you know, executive rental space to woodworking shops and all type of things. But, you know, anything that you've got high dollar assets, it makes sense.
Makes sense to have it shared.
And I think we'll continue to see that. I think we'll see that in the future. There's already talk about cars in, or, you know, in city areas. You may not need a car every day.
Right.
You know, and car sharing and that type of stuff. So I think it really just reflects how, as our whole economy expands and becomes more complex, we have to be adaptive to be successful.
Absolutely. Speaking of that, one of the companies driving a lot of these changes is Amazon. Mm. And they have this new Amazon Fresh Pickup. Has that come across your desk, and is that something that you're looking at tying the shared kitchen to?
You know, we have to walk kind of a fine line between being adaptive for our members and being supportive of our members, but yet being a neutral third party.
Okay.
So a lot of, you know, we have clients that have Amazon sales sites and whatnot, and may take that approach as far as a marketing strategy. But from our standpoint, we are the facility, and we don't really have a direct relationship, so to speak, in the product delivery. That's not to say that, given a creative enough mind, if somebody brought something to my desk that showed us a way to create synergies within the kitchen, certainly with that might not be an interesting way to look. But we've always worked really, really hard at being neutral and making sure that our procedures and our guidelines are such that, you know, just because you're a teeny tiny brand new company, you still have access and, you know, equal, you know, access to the kitchen, really. So I think it would probably put us in a precarious situation if we tried to go deeper into individual basis, because it could create that appearance of a favoritism. A lot of them basically are competitors with each other. And while we have a great kind of family atmosphere in the kitchen, you know, the reality of it is, if he gets the gig, you may not. So, you know, it's really important for us, I think, to stay arm's length.
Is that how you positioned yourself relative to some of the others who've entered this space of providing shared kitchen services? You've cultivated a family atmosphere,
right,
targeting and allowing the most flexible,
right,
pricing approach that I've seen. Is that what differentiates you?
I think so. You know, and I very much think that there are there are other kitchens in the area, and certainly that this is a trend that we're seeing throughout the country.
Right.
I think fit is very important, and our strength here, I believe, very much is in our people. I have a fabulous staff here that is very willing to help and work with you and support you and be a cheerleader and that type of stuff. So I think it's very important for somebody that's looking at this industry to look at their options and to follow what feels like the best fit for them from a facility standpoint, from a staff standpoint. Our next really exciting possibility that we're looking with is, it's always been a challenge for us to have potential clients come to us that, in spite of the fact that we really lowered the threshold for market entry, they still had resource gaps. You know, whether it was from a financial standpoint or a training standpoint, they still just had barriers in the market. So we're looking right now at partnering with a 501c3 nonprofit that would actually help to raise some funds to support these entrepreneurs, they would meet certain requirements for socially and economically disadvantaged, that they would be able to come in and offer like a scholarship type program that would be not only financial resources but also some training resources to, again, help bridge those gaps. So, you know, I think that's something that kind of follows our mission of, you know, we're not here to make $1 million or, you know, offer you everything your business is going to need. We're here to help put businesses into the marketplace and to support you however we can. So, you know, I think that fits more with us staying in our lane.
Sure, absolutely. But that makes sense, because then now I won't ask the question, though I will throw it out there. There's a company in China called Home Cook, and they have launched a startup allowing people to sell home cooked meals on the internet.
Isn't
that kind of interesting? So you have people who will cook dinner, and then they'll say, I just cooked a pot of whatever.
Right.
And just say, I got 8 servings, and whoever gets here first can get one of those servings. And what that startup has created is a demand for more shared kitchens, because the government has come in and said, you can't do that in your home.
That made all the regulators just
right. And so there's a U.S. company that followed down that path last month to create the same sort of concept. And again, it's spurring the same sort of regulatory reaction of get these guys to a shared kitchen, and then they can serve these sorts of things. To your point earlier of how this market is kind of de-evolving and reassembling, I think you're, again, in that sweet spot, and you're sticking right to your lane. Here's what we can provide.
Right.
And I think that's kind of cool to partner with a nonprofit that gives you greater reach to open up more opportunities for even smaller players to create value.
Because, you know, I think where my passion for entrepreneurship in general comes is with the personal responsibility. It's like, I'm going to help you get your feet on the ground. It's up to you to run the race.
That's right.
So, you know, I'm going to lay the track out in front of you as best I can. And then I'm just going to stand back and say, go, baby, go. But I can't ultimately, you know, I can't be the one to go down the track.
Right.
So, you know, we can continue again to look for, maybe we can give them some shoes and maybe we can give them a good starting block or whatnot.
Right.
But, you know, ultimately they have to be the ones to run the race. And I think that, that's where we can provide the most value.
Give me a couple of testimonials of customers who come through that you look at now and go, that was my baby, now look at them.
You know, they all, it's so funny, because a lot of times they do feel like our babies. And there's actually an end cap at Publix Market now that has a lot of local products. And I'm always snapping pictures going, that's one of ours, or they used to be one of ours.
Right.
So that's always really exciting. We have a pie company I know that started with us back in Suwannee, and she is Crave Pie. She's over in the Duluth area, and she graduated, which is what, into her own facility. And she's now doing very well. Has been been there for years, and that's exciting for us, because that's ultimately the goal, is that if that's what they want to move to the next level, that's graduation, is moving into their own facility and being self-sustaining. And I think that it would have been probably impossible for her to do that had she not started out in this environment and been able to build that revenue stream.
What advice would you give to a culinary entrepreneur that's starting out right now, maybe looking at this broadcast and thinking about launching a business?
Be adaptive. Be open to change, because I can tell you the shared kitchens we have today is not at all like what I imagined when it was a spark in my head. It looks different. It feels different. It has evolved and grown. And I think that that's not a value judgment of the way. It's not better or worse. It just is. And I think that, you know, things constantly change, and a true entrepreneur needs to be able to adapt to that. And you need, you know, the food industry, it changes. You know, there's the flavor du jour constantly. A few years ago it was cilantro, now it's kale. You know, there's always the newest thing coming out. And being able to be adaptive but not limited by that. And I think, you know, the added truism of you just can never give up. You know, for every journey up the hill, there's a journey down the hill. And, right. You know, it's a matter of appreciating both parts of the journey for what they are and weathering through it, I think.
I interview quite a few female executives in startups, mm-hmm. And ask for a female perspective in business, particularly in mm-hmm. startups. What's your advice? What's your feedback? What's your journey been like from that perspective?
You know, and this may not be the right thing to say these days. I don't feel like I have ever been defined or limited in any way by my gender. It may be different had I been in different fields. I mean, I was in fairly female-friendly fields with accounting and sales. If I had been in technology, maybe that would have been different. But, you know, I think sometimes we create our own limitations. And, you know, people's perceptions are going to be what they are. A lot of times people's perceptions are instantaneous and can be changed, you know. So if somebody wanted to limit me by, you know, because I was a female or whatnot, I would just kind of take that as a challenge. It's like, okay, well, I'm going to show you that it's really not, you know.
Right.
And I really think that we're all different. I think there's advantages to, you know, not to stereotype, but, you know, female personality differences over a standard man, you know. Mm-hmm. It's what makes it a beautiful world. You know, I wouldn't want to feel like I couldn't be feminine or whatnot. It's, you know, it's a part of who I am, and it, you know, that doesn't mean I have to let it limit me.
Right.
Or limit
right.
anyone.
Right. So what do you see the future of shared kitchens, of sharing economy?
You know, sometimes I just keep swimming as fast as I can, and it's hard to really look around the bend of the stream. But, you know, I think that we want to continue and grow our mission and look for ways to be relevant not only to our customers but within our community. We've done some very exciting partnerships with some groups, for instance, that are placing refugees, and we've been able to bring some people in and give them employment. That's exciting for us, and I think that that's something that we want to continue to pursue. You know, I think that the nonprofit side and you know, maybe branching into some more services where we can support the business side is in our future. But, you know, I think that the biggest thing is resources are finite. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. they always are. So it's our responsibility to look at the resources and say, how can we take these resources and, you know, how can we take the loaf and feed the crowd? You know?
Right. Excellent. Well, this has been terrific. I absolutely love what you're doing. The facility is dynamite. And from a guy that loves the sharing economy, mm-hmm. this just blows my mind that so many people are getting this leg up to make their dreams come true. Tell everybody where they can find you on social media. For those that are interested in launching businesses, how do they get in contact with you and maybe start their relationship with the Shared Kitchen?
We do have a website. It's, as you would expect, www.sharedkitchens.com. And that's going to outlay all of our membership plans. Now I'm old and old school, so I don't Twitter and I don't Snapchat and all that kind of stuff. So we haven't really gotten into that side of social media. But I think we always encourage people to go to the website first, and because that's going to give you a good, you know, kind of broad view of what we offer. And then I think it's important to call and schedule an appointment for a site visit, because that does allow you to walk through and to see, is this a good fit for me?
Excellent. Well, this has been terrific. I want to thank you again for being on the Guerrillapreneur podcast. Our tagline is the art of waging small business warfare. And I can't think of any better facility to help someone wage small business warfare than the Shared Kitchen.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Guerrillapreneur Mastermind Interview with Julie Farr of the Shared Kitchen of Decatur, Georgia. This Mastermind Interview episode is brought to you by Shaletta Burke and her recently released single, belong. There are a lot of entrepreneurs who believe that they don't belong because you have crazy ideas that have not been accepted by the mainstream. Well, I am here to tell you that you belong. We belong, and we are going to change the world. Shilita, explain to them the power of belonging. Shilita Burke and her single, Belong. Find her music on Spotify or follow her on YouTube. Shilita Burke, S-H-E-L-I-T-A-B-U-R-K-E. Shilita Burke. You want to feature your song on the podcast? Direct message me on Twitter at Gorillapreneur. I want to thank my Gorillapreneurs for making this podcast global. We have listeners all over the globe, including listeners in the United States, Spain, Germany, United Kingdom, France, China, Russia, Argentina, Kenya, Ghana, South Africa, Nigeria, Ethiopia, Democratic Republic of Congo, Somalia, Ireland, Uganda, Pakistan, India, Bosnia, Japan, the Philippines, Switzerland, Amsterdam, Chile, Brazil, Thailand, Saudi Arabia, Norway, and Vietnam. Wow. I want to also send a special shout out to the team at the UK-based startup iNetGuardian. iNetGuardian is a cloud-based subscription service that allows parents, grandparents, and caregivers of young people to protect their family online on various devices. iNetGuardian allows you to control how much access the device will have to the internet, monitor the searches on the device, view a timeline of internet browsing by showing web pages that the device has accessed, showing websites that have been blocked, or just monitoring the device to understand your child's usage. Please check them out on the web at inetguardian.co.uk or on Facebook at Facebook/inet guardian, all one word, or on Twitter at inet_guardian. Guys, thanks for being loyal listeners, and I look forward to hanging out with you guys on my next trip to the UK. I especially want to thank Miss Julie Farr of the Shared Kitchen located in Decatur, Georgia. She spent time with us and showed us how this business model works. Please check out Shared Kitchens on the web at sharedkitchensplural.com. I want to also thank my girl Shilita Burke. Check out that single Belong. That's a hot track. Find it on Spotify or follow her on YouTube. Gorillapreneurs, if you're not breaking something, your company might be the next thing that gets broken. So remember what Scott Sullivan said in episode 7. Be a mace, sharpen those spikes, and go break something.
Thank you for listening to the Gorillapreneur, the Art of Waging Small Business Warfare podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, you may also enjoy the book, Gorillapreneur, Small Business Strategy for Davids Wanting to Defeat Goliaths, available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and iTunes. Follow Mark Peterson on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Gorillapreneur. Now I want to close with a quote from the great Chinese military strategist Sun Tzu. Victorious warriors win first and then go to war, while defeated warriors go to war first, then seek to win. Keep fighting, Gorillapreneurs!